Good morning. It's Saturday, November 15th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Catherine Davis. Catherine Davis is the author of five novels, Labrador, The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf, Hell, a Novel, The Walking Tour, Versailles, and The Thin Place. She has received a Kafka Prize for Fiction by an American Woman, the Morton Darwin Zabel Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. In 2006, she won a Lannan Foundation Literary Award. She is the senior fiction writer on the faculty of the writing program at Washington University. When Catherine and I spoke in October, I asked her to talk about how she became a writer.
I started writing when I was a little girl. I knew from, I think, you know, when I first had the idea that a person could do something in life, that I wanted to make books. And I wrote and illustrated my books. Uh-huh. So there was a, for a long time I didn't know, did I want to, you know, be a writer or a visual artist of some kind. I went back and forth for many years, but the first books I wrote were a little, you know, things on paper that I sewed together. And then they had all these, the sort of trappings of real books, like there would be a dedication page and a copyright.
That's fun.
So that's the earliest. And I had those marbleized composition books. Mm-hmm. After making the books, then I had a lot of marbleized composition books, I'd say when I was about 9 or 10 years old, that I thought of as novels, and they were all about horses. And I remember one time thinking up the name Lightning for the horse and thinking, oh God, that's such a great name. No one's ever thought of this before. So, but I was always writing, always reading, being read to, writing. It was sort of the best thing going.
And then as a student, did you study writing? Or,
well, first I went to art school. You know, there weren't writing classes mm-hmm. the way there are now mm-hmm. back in the Stone Age when I was going to school. When I was in high school, there were no writing classes, but we wrote a lot mm-hmm. of, you know, critical papers. So writing was still something I was doing, and reading, mm-hmm. which I think is really important, mm-hmm. the reading part. And then I went to a studio art school where you didn't write anything, and I just painted.
I was going to say, what was your medium? So
paint.
Do you still paint?
No, I totally stopped. Uh-huh. I realized at some point that though I had, you know, gone back and forth, do I want to paint? Do I want to write? That I really was not such a good painter. And I wanted, whatever I did, I wanted to be good at it. Mm-hmm. So in art school, there were people who were much, much, much better than I was. And my paintings also were constantly criticized for having much too much narrative in them.
Hmm.
You know, this is more of an illustration than fine art, is what I would be told.
So you always had stories to tell, maybe.
Yeah, there was some way I wanted something narrative to be going on, and so I didn't write then. Then I went to Barnard College, where I thought I'd be a medieval studies major, and didn't take any, you know, creative. There weren't creative writing classes, mm-hmm. Or not that you could take at Barnard.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Koch was teaching a writing class at Columbia, which we were misleadingly promised we could get into, and then you couldn't get into it if you went to Barnard. And then I went back to art school briefly, to Cooper Union. There went many places. Mm-hmm. Then I ended up at Goddard.
Okay.
And at Goddard, that was the first time I took a writing class, and it was poetry. Because I thought I didn't have the attention span to write anything longer. Based on I'm not sure what, but and so for a while I wrote poetry, and I continued to paint at Goddard. And then again, at some point, I realized that I liked reading fiction much better than I liked reading poetry, generally speaking. And I should be, I thought, writing what I most like to read.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like good advice.
It does, although it's probably served you well to have studied poetry first.
I'm sure it did, and I still, there's poetry I really love.
Right, right. Well, having read The Thin Place, I would say the poetry definitely influenced it.
Well, the sound of the language is really important to me. To have my ear involved in the creation of a sentence or a paragraph, or the transition between parts, which was really huge in The Thin Place,
mm-hmm.
because it moves from section to section, and I knew that there were jumps, but I wanted it to sound right when it made those moves.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I determined that was with my ears. I mean, I always write with my ears.
So do you read out loud when you've written?
Sometimes I'll read aloud, sometimes it's just I write and then I read over in my head.
And you can hear it.
And I hear it.
The Thin Place is such a fantastic book. When it opens, it seems like it's about to tell a certain story about a handful of people. And then it unexpectedly presents a story that encompasses so much more. It seems like it has no boundaries at all about people and animals and the earth and spirit. And it seems daunting to undertake a book like that. And I was wondering if you ever got overwhelmed while you were writing it.
I never got overwhelmed writing this book, because the book, it's exactly the way I look at the world. I mean, I really did feel like, in a way, it just felt like it was not easy. It wasn't easy, but all the things I wanted to put in it seemed to me to be crucial in terms of, you know, telling a story. The story that I wanted to tell,
mm-hmm.
wasn't, you know, a sort of traditional kind of narrative. It was sort of a story of people in a place at a particular time, and I knew I wanted as many different elements to be in there, because I sort of always find myself, you know, tuned in to plants and animals. I mean, not like I'm a Saint Francis or anything, but it's just interesting that there are all these different things going on around us, many things that you can't see, or the history of a place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what formed the rocks that you walk on? All of that just seems so critical to me in understanding everything that's going on between people in a place.
Right. I liked just the fact that reading this book made me stop and think more about all these things that you take for granted every day.
Good.
Yeah. Can you explain the title, The Thin Place?
Yeah. The title, I heard that expression the first time I was visiting a friend who was a lay member of a religious community, St. Mary's Convent,
mm-hmm.
in Peekskill, New York. And I was visiting, and then had decided I was going to stay a little longer than I had intended and do a silent vigil. And it was a really amazing experience. And when you can talk, the one time you can talk to the sisters is at tea time, when their vow of silence is released. And they were talking about how they thought that this convent was, one of the sisters said she thought it was in a thin place. and I hadn't heard that phrase before. And she explained to me that it was a Celtic term, she thought, for a place where the veil between, you know, this world and the material world and the spiritual world is very, very thin. Okay. And there's leakage between the two.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
You must have been so excited.
I actually can't remember whether I had started writing the book. I don't think I'd started writing the book. I think I heard that phrase and I had some ideas about what I wanted to do next. And uh-huh. I thought, well, there's the title. Because mostly I have my titles before I have anything else.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and
do you?
So that was a great one.
Now, you hear stories about publishers changing titles. Has that not been your experience?
Well, it never has happened to me. And the title to me is so much a part of the book that the idea of changing a title is horrifying to me. I mean, I know that that can happen,
right.
But I'm pretty determined. That would be not all right. That would be like having a story that has a sad ending and having the editor say, well, don't you think we ought to change this so, you know, Mary Jane actually lives in the end? you can't do that.
Yeah. As a writer reading this book, I'm going to see if I can, how to put this. The experience of reading The Thin Place felt to me much more like the discovery of writing than any other book I've ever read. Does that make sense? There's just a discovery process in writing that is so exciting, and I don't find that that always happens when I'm reading a book, but it did happen with this book.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to say about it. I don't know what that would be due to necessarily, though I do know that the way I work, and I'm not the only person who works this way, but I don't work with an outline.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea what I'm doing. It's not just like jumping off a cliff. But it's really important to me to keep the process of discovery very alive
mm-hmm.
as I write. Otherwise, it would feel too much like connecting the dots, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I would lose interest.
The book has many religious references, but they seem almost unique as far as religion goes. I know that the church where people meet in the book is of a certain religion, but there's a sense of spirit running through that seems apart from that, or apart from any one religion, and
right.
I'm wondering if that was purposeful.
I don't know, purposeful makes it sound like I thought this is what I want to do, where what I wanted to do was reveal as I wrote how I see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be, what you described, that would be a good description of what I would have hoped
mm-hmm.
I revealed.
Good.
Which is, I think every book I've ever written, I have been preoccupied with the question of what is it that animates us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what makes us be living beings, sort of beyond what you learn in health class. I mean, it's always been clear to me that there's some spiritual component, for want of a better word, that animates the human body
mm-hmm.
and animals and everything. And I'm interested in it. I believe really strongly that that is not, you know, that awareness or whatever good one derives from the fact that one possesses something like a soul, if that's what you want to call it, is not something that you can pin to a particular, religious
discipline,
denomination.
Right.
I do go to the Episcopal Church here in Montpelier which I adore. Mm-hmm. But I also practice yoga, and I read things like the Upanishads. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I believe that it's a very, very rich world spiritually, and I want to, you know, sort of keep pursuing my understanding of that, and I don't want it to be narrow.
Mm-hmm. There's so many wonderful details. You really feel when you're reading this what it must be like to be a young beaver rebuilding a dam on a warm evening, for one example, or what it's like to be a dog trying to break out of the yard. I don't want to ask you another question about having planned things ahead of time, because I know you don't, but as you're working into some of these unusual narrative viewpoints, do you find yourself going through certain exercises or anything to put yourself in that narrative point of view?
I believe in that writing exercises are great. I think that having taught and then having done a number, you know, having done lots of exercises of one sort or another, there's something in my writerly disposition that functions as if that's what is up, sort of no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I try to give myself license to go with something the way you would with a writing exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I know that revision is an enormous part of the process of making a book work, mm-hmm. and though I consider myself a prose stylist, so I don't just write down any old anything. I'm pretty careful, as even in an early draft stage. I also try very hard not to be telling myself too much what I ought to be doing, so that there's room for things to come out and surprise me. The beavers are really a good example of that in the book, because all of my knowledge of the beavers comes from living for a while in North Callis, where we lived near Number 10 Pond,
mm-hmm.
and there was just a huge problem with beavers. And we had a little pond. Our house had a little pond with a little waterfall, and when the beavers built a dam off Number 10 Pond, our lovely little pond would turn to just a mud pile.
Oh.
And so I was part of this whole neighborhood militia to try to get rid of the beavers. And first we would take down what the beavers built. I mean, all this I did put into the book. And we would dismantle the dam, and then they'd rebuild it. And then I looked into the hiring of a beaver trapper. And he tried to trap the beavers, and the beavers were too clever for him. And I was completely possessed with the idea of getting rid of the beavers. This was just the amazing thing that can happen when you are writing and sort of inhabiting the world of a book. I wanted the beavers to be part of the world of this book, and the community in particular,
yeah.
out there, away from town. But when I started to write about the beavers, I became appalled that I would ever have wanted to do them harm. In fact, I even, you know, at one point was writing about the beavers, and you had tears streaming down. I was just like, how could I have wanted to kill those beavers? So it was an unexpected wrinkle. And the other animals weren't surprises to me. I mean, I know how I feel about dogs and cats and, you know, even, you know, deer and moose and,
mm-hmm.
yeah, but the beavers, that was quite a surprise.
Now, corn, I never knew anybody who felt so strongly about corn. That was funny.
Thank you.
There's a section in the book in which you talk about the personality of corn. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of like once you open the door to anything, then as I'd be in a landscape, I would think, well, why not? Why not the corn?
Right, right.
Why not the mold?
Well, it was perfect because it just led it so naturally there. Anyway, before we talk anymore, I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read from the book.
Sure.
This is Catherine Davis reading the opening of The Thin Place, which is published by Little Brown.
There were three girlfriends, and they were walking down a trail that led to a lake. One small and plump, one pretty and medium-sized, one not so pretty and tall. This was in the early years of the 21st century. The unspeakable having happened so many times, everyone was still in shock, still reeling from what they'd seen, what they'd done or failed to do. The dead souls no longer wore gowns. They'd gotten loose, broadcasting their immense soundless cord through the precincts of the living. At the lake, the trail branched right and left. Right to the town beach, a grassy plot with six picnic tables, two stone grills, a pit toilet, a trash can, and a narrow strip of lumpy gray sand. Left to the knoll, where the overlarge houses of the rich nestled among shade trees and tasteful redwood play structures, and then back to town. Straight ahead was the boat ramp and the Crockett's chocolate lab, Buddy, going down shoulder first on a dead fish. Beyond the ramp was the water. The sky was the palest blue and fluttered over the girls' heads like a circus tent at the apex of which the sun was pinned. It was a Saturday in mid-May, the sun only just starting to heat up, it being the northern latitudes. But even so, Mrs. Kipp had made sure they all wore sunblock. You couldn't be too careful. Like many objects of worship, the sun had grown impatient with its worshippers, causing some of them to sicken and die. As she larded on the sunblock, Mrs. Kipp informed them that these days only stupid people had tans. When they got to the beach, the three girls came to a halt. A very large man, dressed in a pair of khaki shorts and not much else, was lying on his stomach in the sand with his head facing the lake. From where the girls stood, they could see the bottoms of the man's feet, which looked smooth and white. Almost as if he were a baby, observed Lorna Fine, not only the tallest and least attractive, but also the most fanciful of the three. The older Lorna got, the prettier she would become, but for now she was like a bespectacled monkey wearing red and yellow plaid seersucker pants and the vintage Ramones t-shirt she'd found in the back of her brother's closet under a stack of dirty magazines, so she was sure he wouldn't ask for it back. Sonny Crockett let out a loud sigh Lorna knew was meant to be overheard by anyone inconsiderate enough to be hogging the entire strip of sand when obviously there were other people who wanted to use it. It's Mr. Banner, said Mies Kipp. Who? Lorna asked. Mr. Banner, said Mies, from Sonny's church. She walked around to the man's right where she planted herself, a small round thing in a pink tracksuit, in the sand next to his face. Mr. Banner's eyes were loosely shut, and his black eyeglasses were shoved up, so the left lens was wedged over the bridge of his nose, which was bruised and bleeding. His mouth was partly open, and a little foamy drool was coming out of it. There were several black fly bites, the first of the season, on his bald head, and four long, fine hairs were growing out of the middle of his nose, halfway between the bridge and the nostrils. Noon. The sun shone down. Mies leaned closer. Mr. Banner smelled like perspiration, but also sweet like cotton candy, and there was something about him, about the way he lay there, so perfectly still, yet with a sense of something enormously alive inside him, something almost insanely teeming with slumberous hidden vitality deep inside that made her feel like she was looking at a cave full of sleeping bats. Don't, said Lorna, when Mies reached out a finger. Don't touch him. Germs, guessed Sonny. But Lorna, a great fan of Agatha Christie, shook her head. I don't think he's breathing, she said. Look at his chest. Tentatively, she held her hand near the man's nose. I think he's dead. The sand was coarse and gritty, the entire beach hard as a rock. If there were any footprints, Lorna couldn't make them out, though despite the trash can, there was a lot of trash on the ground, including cigarette butts and a beer bottle. Molson, Canadian. We should do something, said Sonny. We should get help. You get help, said Mies. I'm staying here. It's not like he's going anywhere, Lorna pointed out. But once Mies had made her mind up, forget it. Just try not to touch anything, Lorna added sternly. Okay? Of course, Lorna knew perfectly well that the minute she and Sonny were out of sight, Mies would do just that. It had been so obvious, her hand visibly itching to touch the man's cheek. Sure, Mies said. She nodded her small round face, a face that no doubt, due to its exceptionally round dark eyes and full bow lips, its fringe of dark hair and pronounced widow's peak, tended to remind people of a pansy. Such a sweet little flower, with such a fierce expression. Mr. Banner, Mies was thinking. Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner. Think of me. That was what pansy said in the language of flowers.
Thank you. You're welcome. Can you talk a little bit about the structure of the book? The police, there's sections of police reports, horoscope, gardener's almanac. There are voices telling what happened. The structure is very interesting, and it seems actually very well organized once you sort of study it from that perspective. As you're reading, it's a surprise as you go. But then looking back when you finish the book, it seems very ordered.
Oh, it is very ordered. Although I wanted it to have the appearance of the way things happen in life, as if with no discernible order, because that seems to me to be the way it really does kind of work. And I wanted there to be, again, this goes back to the question of ear, mm-hmm. that for me, this is not to say that the sense of something isn't really important, but when I'm deciding where to move from one place in a narrative to another, the sound of what will follow, whatever precedes it, is really important. Almost, I sometimes feel like what I'm doing is, you know, composing a piece of music, mm-hmm. and I think this is a very flat-sounding section, purposefully. For instance, the police blotter notes. I like the kind of flatness of the abrupt language and the flatness of it, and for that to exist in juxtaposition to something that is much less flat, maybe, you know, borderline lyrical, it seems like a good move, mm-hmm. so that you don't get you hear up to a certain point, then by contrast you really hear what preceded it and what follows also by contrast you hear in a different way. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of that kind of thinking that went into the organization. But I also knew I wanted the police blotter. I'm really in love with those police notes that we get in the Times Argus.
It was fun reading the police blotter too, because some of the line items didn't in fact have anything to do with the narrative that
right.
we were familiar with. Some of them were very recognizable within that narrative, and then eventually you come to this point where you feel like it's irrelevant because this is all relevant.
Right.
Does
right.
that make,
yeah. Yes, that's what I wanted. That was what I wanted. And really, the ones that are so particular to the plotted plot, there aren't that many of them. And a lot of that I really did just get right out of the newspaper.
Oh, okay. That's funny. This is a small point, but the narrative tells us at one point that in the Bible, dogs are mentioned 16 times and cats zero. Is that true?
Yeah.
How did you learn that?
I looked in a concordance. It's a kind of indexing system.
And on the computer,
or? No, it probably exists now on the computer, but I have a really old concordance, and you look up dog, and it will give you all, you know, chapter and verse, all of the references to dogs. Then you can, you know, look them up if you want to. And I did look up dog. I was just interested to see, and I saw there were quite a lot of references to dogs. And then I thought, I wonder, this wasn't even to write that line. It was just
out of curiosity.
Idle curiosity. And there were no references to cats. So I, you know, made a little note. This will come in handy at some point.
Right. Did you do a lot of research when you were writing The Thin Place?
I did much less research on this book, I would say, than on any of the other books I've written. I did some. For instance, I don't just know off the top of my head about, you know, the geologic history of mm-hmm. Central Vermont. And the book is set in Central Vermont, even though it tries really hard not to say so.
How do you say the name of the town?
Varennes.
Is it sort of Vergennes that gave you the idea of Varennes, or not really?
I always thought Vergennes, that sounded good. I didn't want to use a name that existed
right
here. I knew there were a lot of French names of towns in this area, and I figured if it's clear that it's near Canada, mm-hmm. That would work. And then I had just written a book, you know, before this, about Marie Antoinette, and the flight to Varennes is a big chapter in that story. And I thought, that's a perfect name. It's perfect. And I like importing something from one book into the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, a little touch.
Mm-hmm. So just a little connection there. Running through the background of the book is the story of a woman named Inez Fair, a teacher who was involved in a tragic accident over 100 years before the active storyline. I'm wondering what role her story plays within the book, in your opinion.
I wanted there to be historic and not geologic history, but the more, you know, within recent memory history of the town,
mm-hmm.
that there would be a kind of, that the town would be haunted by a story, because that seems to me to be the case in places, that there will be some way in which the history, the stories of the past don't go away,
mm-hmm.
and remain present for the people who are alive now.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought that the whole idea of attentiveness and inattentiveness, and the degree of responsibility a person has for another person's life,
mm-hmm.
and what role is played by how attentive you are or inattentive,
right.
was something I was really interested in.
Because she was ultimately responsible for the accident.
She was.
Because of her inattention.
Exactly.
Right.
And yet she, you know, you couldn't say she was, you know, a bad person for that.
Right.
So there was, and degrees of, you know, goodness and badness, or the way in which a person could be held accountable or blamed, all of it sort of, you know, culminating in the final scene in the church. I that was interesting to me. Like, you know, who saves whom and why, and how does that happen?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that motif, the Inez Fair story, that motif was a kind of note, I hoped, that would echo the story going on in the present of the book with the church.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed reading this description of Lorna, a teenage character who writes, who you've just introduced us to in your reading. I think I like this because I'm a writer, but Lorna got to make things up, which Lorna was beginning to realize was a dubious advantage, since when you did that, everyone could tell what was going on inside your brain. Is that how you feel at times?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I you know, with students, it's always amused me that students will have the misconception that if they, for instance, aren't writing autobiographically, purely autobiographically, or even, you know, sort of thinly disguised autobiography, if they're, for instance, setting something that they're writing on a distant planet, or, you know, it's got elves or something, that somehow they're protecting themselves from being revealed, and that never happens. You just can't avoid it.
Right. It is your creativity that brought this to us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just got your thumbprints and fingerprints all over it in the most amazing ways. I really like that about it. Because then that's sometimes a way you can also find out something. You write something, then you read it, you realize something about yourself that you hadn't really been aware of until you kind of put it down in so many words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the beavers.
Right. Another issue that I thought more about in reading this book was just that there's a relationship between the writer and the reader that involves trust. And a reader, at a certain point, just kind of has to let go and trust that the writer is going to take them there.
Yeah.
And this book has enough going on in very interesting and complicated ways that if you try too hard to figure it all out as you go, it's difficult. But as a reader, you can kind of let go and say, okay, I'm just going to trust that this is going to take me somewhere. And it does.
I like reading books where you feel like you just put yourself in the writer's hands,
mm-hmm.
and you don't necessarily know where you're going. In fact, I prefer not to know and to just give myself over that way. And I certainly know that when I used to write poetry, when I used to work in the Writers in the Schools program here in Vermont, and I'd go into elementary school classrooms, and there we were just working with these little kids writing poetry and reading them, you know, all sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
and basically making the point, don't get yourself all screwed up in knots trying to figure out what's going on. Just sort of, you know, fall back into the hands of the poet,
mm-hmm.
and see where it takes you, see where those hands take you. So that's, I like that.
Mm-hmm. And that's really true of poetry, isn't it?
And often it doesn't make sense. I mean, often you can't make sense out of something the way you make sense out of a legal brief. You
mm-hmm.
just can't do that. I mean, you don't want it to be a hodgepodge. I often also talk to my students about the difference between mystifying your reader or confusing your reader. And it's fine for the reader, I think, to be mystified and to remain that way. To be confused, not good.
Right. Who are some of your favorite writers?
The writers who I think have had a huge influence on me, definitely Franz Kafka.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things I've read over and over again. There's a novella of Flaubert's called A Simple Heart that was a big influence on The Thin Place for me. I really love Charlotte Bronte and Emily Bronte, going back to early reading, Tolstoy, Henry James, Virginia Woolf.
Mm-hmm.
I've been rereading a lot and less, you know, eager to read newer stuff,
mm-hmm.
because I like seeing how the rereading of something that I was really, really familiar with at one time in my life. As you, when you read it later, you see how you are changed by your reaction
right
to the book.
And you can see probably how it affected you as a writer.
Right.
Yeah. At one point in The Thin Place, you offer predictions about certain characters. It's only for a page, and then you stop. I was curious if you remember why you decided to share these characters' futures, or possible futures, but it sounded pretty probable.
Well, there were two reasons for that. One is that, you know, I always want to put in things that I really like in when I write. That I particularly like for sort of no reason that I can totally understand. And I always love it if I go see a movie and at the end of the movie, after the movie's all over, there's that part that scrolls through that says, Benjamin Harrison went on to become a... And there's a whole list of things that happen after the world of the movie ended. Mm-hmm. There's something really appealing to me about that. I think it's that feeling that the world that you've been in keeps going in the way that the world does. So that was a part of it. I just like it. And but it seemed particularly appropriate to this book because here I wanted the sense of the wholeness, that there were these whole lives, and in a book you only get a piece of the whole big picture. And so to say this is going to happen and this is going to happen is a way of acknowledging the fact that you can't put everything in.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of bowing down before that limitation.
I liked, too, that you finished that section by saying, you know, and this person will die, and this person will die, and this person will die, and then you realize, yeah, sure, because everyone dies.
Because they all will,
yes,
exactly.
They will all die.
Exactly.
That was And then you just moved on with the story as it was at that moment. So my last question for you, as a writer and a teacher, do you have any exercises or activities that help you if you get stuck in your work? I know you said that you do like exercises.
This is not exactly an exercise, but this is only really useful if you're working on something long enough that you come back to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, day after day. So it's good advice and helps prevent stuckness is my sense of this. And that is that I'm pretty sure it was Ernest Hemingway who said you should never stop writing, you know, at the end of the day, where you've finished up something and you really have no idea where you're going to go next. It's
mm-hmm.
a bad place to leave your work. And I think that's really good advice, that you want to leave a little door open in some way.
Okay.
So my sort of version of that, which is to tempt yourself back to the desk the next day, because it's the regular sitting at the desk and writing that I think is the real antidote to writer's block. Because there you are, sitting. You sort of have to do something. So what I like to do is, number one, make sure that I'm not stopping at a point that's a real conclusion. But I also give myself license to just sort of let loose with whatever comes out of my head, and not full sentences, just gibberish in a way. At the
beginning of a work period?
At the end of a work period. Because by that time I've been working, I've been concentrating, I've been maybe moving things around, there's been a certain amount of arduous is a kind of overstatement, but you know, that kind of work. And what I do is I just say, okay, no more work. Just let whatever is kind of bubbling around inside and let it out. No spelling, no punctuating, no thinking, really. And I do it, you know, I just let it go on for, you know, like a block, a big paragraph worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't read it. I don't read any of what I did that particular day. I print it out and I put it, you know, in a place where I can look at it the next day, first thing. But I don't read it over then because I'm very curious and want to know. And so I keep myself curious.
Oh, okay. That curiosity wards off any sort of inability to move forward.
It does. I think it really does work pretty well.
Oh,
it probably works given my disposition. I don't know if it will work for, you know, everybody, but I really am interested to sit down and see what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And the most amazing thing is that reading, and I make notes then, you know, fixing stuff, reading through, but by the time I get to the gibberish, there's usually something really, really great and useful there.
Huh.
That helps me just keep moving forward.
And get started the next day.
Yeah. I mean, not much of it, but like there's something that comes out that way. So that's what I do.
Well, that's wonderful, guys. Thank you for that. And thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Catherine Davis. Next week, tune in again at 9 a.m. to hear an interview with Vermont author of prose and poetry, Sydney Lee. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. St. Johnsbury author Beth Cannell reads from her first novel, The Darkness Under the Water, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on Saturday, November 15th, that's today, at 11 a.m. The Green Mountain Animal Defenders 25th Anniversary Celebration takes place tonight at 4:30 at the Doubletree Hotel in South Burlington. Authors Gary Kowalski, Deborah Shaw, Dr. Jonathan Balcombe, and Aaron Williams will be in attendance signing copies of their books. For more information, call 861-3030. Dan Snow, dry stonewaller and author of the book Listening to Stone, will be at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex on Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. Attendees will also have the opportunity to view the documentary Stone Rising, the work of Dan Snow, and to speak to producer-director Camilla Rockwell. Critically acclaimed author and UVM alum Douglas Smith will talk about his new book, The Pearl, a true tale of forbidden love in Catherine the Great's Russia, on Monday, November 17th at 4 p.m. in the Waterman Building at UVM in Burlington. Michael Schumann, author of the award-winning Small Mart Revolution, will speak about local entrepreneurship, how Vermont can prosper while the global economy melts down. This event takes place at the Vermont State House in Montpelier on Tuesday, November 18th at 4. For more information, call 888-222-3413. UVM Professor Hilary Neroni moderates a discussion of The Quitter at the South Burlington Community Library on Tuesday, November 18th at 7. I believe The Quitter is written by Harvey P. Carr and Dan Haspiel. You'd have to call the library to be sure. It wasn't in the press release. This talk is part of the library's book discussion series on Jewish literature. Call 652-7080 for more information. Anthropologist and author Anne Armbrecht presents her new book, Thin Places, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on Tuesday, November 18th at 7. Not to be confused with the book you heard discussed in the interview today, which is titled The Thin Place, Armbrecht's book, Thin Places, is based on her own experiences in Nepal and the United States. The South Burlington Community Library hosts its second book discussion, focusing on international mysteries, led by Marilyn Burrington. A discussion of the book, Faceless Killers, by Henning Mankell, takes place on Wednesday, November 19th at 7. Local author and photographer Naki Goranin speaks about her recently published book, American Photo Booth, at the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington on Thursday, November 20th at noon. Naomi Miller hosts and facilitates a discussion of the book Songcatcher by Sharon McCrum at the South Burlington Community Library on Thursday, November 20th at 7. Author David McCauley presents his latest book, The Way We Work, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on Friday, November 21st at 7. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard today with Catherine Davis, the novelist of The Thin Place. To avoid getting stuck and maintain her interest in an ongoing project, Catherine said she does two main things. First, she does not read over what she's written at the end of a given writing session. She waits and reads that work when she next sits down to write. Second, as she finishes each writing session, she winds down by allowing herself to free write for a page or so. This encourages thoughts and ideas that might have been deterred by her more focused or controlled thought process as she was working. She mentioned that useful ideas often come out of this end-of-day free writing. The next time you write, try these two strategies. First, do not allow yourself to read over your work when you finish writing at the end of a given day. Wait until your next writing session. And second, spend 5 or 10 minutes free writing after a regular disciplined writing session and see what fresh, useful, and relevant ideas might result. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, in Burlington, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.